This is June 4th, 2017, and before I begin with the Teisho proper, just a sharing a little bit about a big day here yesterday. We agreed to open our doors to the Landmark Society's home and garden tour. They have these in different neighborhoods each year. This year it was on our own street here nearby, and it's the third or fourth time we've been part of this home and garden tour, and it was pretty amazing. There were at 12:15 yesterday, 630 people had come through here. I don't know how many there were by the end of the day. And
1,100.
What? 1,100. Stop. So 1,100 yesterday, and then it was supposed to be from 10 this morning until 4 this afternoon, but they were agreeable to our postponing it so that we could have our sitting and Teisho and brunch this morning. So we won't open our doors to them until 1, I guess, today. Just so half as long a day for people. But just what affected me so much yesterday is seeing all these people, knowing that very few of those 1,100 will ever come back here. Fewer still will come to an introductory workshop, and of those, still fewer will become a member and sit for more than a couple weeks. Knowing that, still, what a wonderful thing. And for this reason, because they clearly had some slight karmic affinity with Zen, with the Dharma. Almost none of them, maybe none of them knew they had this affinity, but the fact that they came here, that they walked through this Dharma center, even though they may all have thought it was just to see the dental molding and the woodwork, it doesn't matter. It's the fact that they came through here, spent 10 or 20 minutes or an hour coming through here, means that there is a causal connection. And for an example of another such thing, when young Philip Kaplow was in Japan for the Tokyo war crimes trials, they had a day of recess. Many of you know this, but I'll just finish the story. They had a day of recess in the trials. This is 1946, and he heard that the Zen temples had some beautiful gardens. So he got on a bus and went to a certain Zen temple and just wandered. He strolled through the garden and met no one. But he was so affected by the serenity, by what? How can you put it into words? He was so affected by it that he made a note to himself to, when he came back to the States, to investigate this thing called Zen. So we're sowing seeds in something like this, knowing that there'll be little to show for it in this lifetime, but who knows as far as the future. So now I want to sort of process this stunning, not so stunning, it wasn't so unexpected, but this decision by our president to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord. Surely everyone hearing this is aware that this happened and the implications of it. I have to honestly say that the morning after this news that he was withdrawing the United States, I felt more disgusted and more disappointed in our country, because we're all in this together, than I have since last November 9th. And I just had some thoughts about all this and wanted to just articulate them to anyone hearing this. First of all, I think David Brooks, my the New York Times columnist, who I see as the most Buddhistic, self-proclaimed conservative Republican columnist I know of, especially the most Buddhistic Jewish conservative Republican columnist I know of, wrote a piece about this that I think really hits the nail on the head. By the way, I learned from Gerardo Sensei, my Dharma heir in Mexico, who's and one of our trustees, who was just reelected as one of our trustees, that Hirado Sensei knew David Brooks when he was a kid. And I get a lot of this. What Hirado said was that the Brooks family fled to Mexico in the 50s during the McCarthy era because they were Marxists. And Gerardo, he was not close friends with little Davy Brooks, but he remembers seeing him running around when the family would visit. So anyway, I'll just plow into this article. It's called this was published by the Times on Friday, the day after Trump's announcement, and it's called "Donald Trump Poisons the World." He quotes two of Donald Trump's top advisors, McMaster and Gary Cohn, who wrote the following passage earlier in the Wall Street Journal, and this is what they said. These two guys said, "The president embarked on his first foreign trip with a clear-eyed outlook that the world is not a, quote, global community, but an arena where nations, non-governmental actors, and businesses engage and compete for advantage." And then Brooks says, "That sentence is the epitome of the Trump project. It asserts that selfishness is the sole driver of human affairs. It grows out of a worldview that life is a competitive struggle for gain. It implies that cooperative communities are hypocritical covers for the selfish jockeying underneath. The essay explains why the Trump people are suspicious of any cooperative global arrangement like NATO and the various trade agreements. It helps explain why Trump pulled out of the Paris Global Warming Accord. This essay explains why Trump gravitates toward leaders like Vladimir Putin, the Saudi princes, and various global strongmen. They share his core worldview that life is nakedly a selfish struggle for money and dominance. It explains why people in the Trump White House are so savage to one another. Far from being a band of brothers, their world is a vicious arena where staffers compete for advantage." In the essay, McMaster and Cohn make explicit the great act of moral decoupling woven through this presidency. In this worldview, morality has nothing to do with anything. Altruism, trust, cooperation, and virtue are unaffordable luxuries in the struggle of all against all. Everything is about self-interest. I still cling to the hope that this is manifesting what has been called the sunset effect, is right before a phenomenon sinks and disappears. It has its most spectacular display of prominence. We've seen this philosophy before, of course. Powerful, selfish people have always adopted this dirty-minded realism to justify their own selfishness. The problem is that this philosophy is based on an error about human beings, and it leads to self-destructive behavior in all cases. Before we hear from him, just what is the error? The error is that it impugns to human nature just one side of our nature. There's no denying that we all are driven to one degree or another by self-interest, by egotism. And presumably it's only through supreme, perfect enlightenment that we completely have this egotism, what one person called this basic narcissism of human beings, before we're free of it. But that's just part of the picture. But I'll go back to him. The error is that it misunderstands what drives human action. Of course people are driven by selfish motivations. But they also are motivated by another set of drives for solidarity, love, and moral fulfillment that are equally and sometimes more powerful. People are wired to cooperate. Far from being a flimsy thing, the desire for cooperation is the primary human evolutionary advantage we have over the other animals. People have a moral sense. They have a set of universal intuitions that help establish harmony between peoples. From their first moments, children are wired to feel each other's pain. You don't have to teach a child about what fairness is. They already know. There's no society on earth where people are admired for running away in battle or for lying to their friends. People have moral emotions. They feel rage at injustice, disgust toward greed, reverence for excellence, awe before the sacred, and elevation in the face of goodness. People yearn for righteousness. They want to feel meaning and purpose in their lives, that their lives are oriented toward the good. Good leaders like Lincoln, Churchill, Roosevelt, and Reagan understand the selfish elements that drive human behavior, but they have another foot in the realm of the moral motivations. They seek to inspire faithfulness by showing good character. They try to motivate action by pointing toward great ideals. Realist leaders like Trump, McMaster, and Cohn, that's not a good use of that word. They're not, if they're only looking at that aspect of human nature, they're not realists. But I'll just read it as he says it. Realist leaders like Trump, McMaster, and Cohn seek to dismiss this whole moral realm. By behaving with naked selfishness toward others, they poison the common realm, and they force others to behave with naked selfishness toward them. By treating the world simply as an arena for competitive advantage, Trump, McMaster, and Cohn sever relationships, destroy reciprocity, erode trust, and eviscerate the sense of sympathy, friendship, and loyalty that all nations need when times get tough. By looking at nothing but immediate material interest, Trump, McMaster, and Cohn turn America into a nation that affronts everybody else's moral emotions. They make our country seem disgusting in the eyes of the world. George Marshall was no realistic patsy. For those who maybe are too young to know who that was, George Marshall instituted, through his management, the United States instituted the Marshall Plan, after World War II, where instead of simply punishing Germany and the other Axis powers, well, Germany at least, which was the big mistake that was made after World War I at Versailles, and that set up the conditions for the rise of Nazism in Germany. Instead of doing that, we opened our arms and poured money into the repair of Germany. Huge, what would today be billions and billions and billions to help them get back on their feet, even after what all that they had done during the war. This is realism. This is recognizing that we have to take the long view and not just react out of emotional, what is most ignoble in us, but try to see beyond the very human and understandable wish for revenge or punishment. George Marshall was no idealistic patsy. He understood that America extends its power when it offers a cooperative hand and volunteers for common service toward a great ideal. Realists, or let's call them misguided realists, reverse that formula. They assume strife and so arouse a volley of strife against themselves. I wish McMaster was a better student of Thucydides, Athenian. He'd know that the Athenians adopted the same amoral tone he embraces. The strong, this is quoting Thucydides, the strong do what they can and the weak suffer what they must. And then Brooks ends by saying the Athenians ended up making endless enemies and destroying their own empire. So here we are now, having abdicated leadership in the arguably the most compelling problem human beings have ever faced in its long history, which is the steady warming of the world. When we have a turn like this last week, where we walked away from what had taken, I'm told, had taken 10 years to cobble together, when we walk away from an agreement that signed by 195 other countries, granted, it was a voluntary agreement, it's not binding, but still great collective statement of awareness of the problem is not for nothing. When this happens, when we find ourselves in the position we are now, it can lead to despair. It can be paralyzing. What good is our efforts, our social political efforts, to save the world when now this happens, undoing so much that had happened? And maybe this is why there was another column in the New York Times written just days before Trump, 2 days actually, 2 days before Trump withdrew from this climate accord. It's called In Praise of Lost Causes. And this is by a segment of the Times, an occasional column called The Stone, like meaning the Philosopher's Stone, or what can be considered more along the way of wisdom, timeless wisdom. But it's called In Praise of Lost Causes. The author is Mariana Alessandri. And she talks about I'll just read the first part. Right after Spain's swift and devastating loss to the United States in 1898, That was the Spanish-American War. The Spanish philosopher Miguel de Unamuno, it's about the coolest name in the world, Unamuno, Miguel de Unamuno, who died in 1936, he resurrected Spain's patron saint of lost causes, Don Quixote de la Mancha. It is fitting that Unamuno chose as Spain's hero her crazy uncle, Cervantes' fictional knight-errant, who was himself well acquainted with swift and devastating losses. For the rest of his life, Unamuno urged his fellow Spaniards to practice quixotism, which meant adopting the moral courage necessary to fight for lost causes without caring what the world thinks. Today, when much of society and politics, both in and outside the United States, looks like a lost cause to a great number of people, we might do well to consider Quixote's brand of lunacy. Abandoning his senses, or rather his common sense, freed up Quixote to engage in fruitless tasks like charging windmills. In the most famous scene of the book, his squire, Sancho Panza, warns Quixote that the giant he is tempted to charge is just a windmill, and as such, should be left alone. Sancho's common sense tells him that fights that are sure to be lost are not worth fighting. Yet it is that same common sense that continually keeps Sancho from engaging with the world. Engaging, good word, engage Buddhism. Likewise, it keeps us from engaging in what are perhaps the worthiest of causes, the lost ones. And lost may not be an exaggeration now in terms of climate change. There are those who feel that we've passed the point of no return. As far as the warming of the poles, rising of the seas. But who knows for sure? But that would be the lost cause that we're talking about this morning. Unamuno believed that it was not Quixote but Sancho who was delusional, firm in his belief that windmills are not worth charging, and, more broadly, that unwinnable battles are not worth fighting. The result of this type of thinking will usually be paralysis, since most enemies are windmill size instead of human size. Sancho believed that tilting at windmills was dangerous. Today, we might just call it a waste of time, and since common sense also tells us that time is money, we'd better steer clear of anything unprofitable. According to the political theorist Joshua Dienstag in his 2006 book, Pessimism, Quixote's loss of common sense offered him a more meaningful metric for deciding which battles are worth fighting. Don Quixote didn't charge the windmill because he thought he would defeat it, but because he concluded it was the right thing to do. Likewise, if we want to be legitimate actors in the world, Unamuno would say that we must be willing to lose the fight. If we abandon the common sense belief that deems only winnable fights worth fighting, we can adopt Unamuno's moral courage and become quixotic pessimists. Pessimists because we recognize our odds of losing are quite high, and quixotic because we might fight, because we fight anyway. Quixotic pessimism is thus marked by a refusal to let the odds of my success determine the value of my fight. On Unamuno's Marxist interpretation of the windmill scene, Quixote recognized that though they might look harmless, the, quote, long-armed giants kept the townspeople sated and distracted enough to forget their oppression at the hands of modern bread factories. You know, as I read this, I think of my own quixotic warnings about what social media and digital devices are doing to us. I think that most people, many people who would hear me say that and hear others say that, just dismiss it as just old people worrying about, unwilling to move along with the times. But I don't think that's the case. And there's mounting evidence that social media and digital devices have such a corrosive effect on not just our own minds and our own natures, but culture more broadly. And yet that warning, that fight, is quixotic. How can you turn that back? The most we can hope for is that people will learn to exercise restraint and keep things in proportion and not withdraw completely into a screen world. But back to the matter at hand here, that these long-armed giants kept the people sated and distracted enough to forget their oppression at the hands of the modern bread factories. You know, Marx or Lenin said that religion is the opiate of the masses. I would suggest that these modern devices are the opiate of the masses. But back to the article, Unamuno complained that instead of asking whether they would ultimately benefit the towns they invade, the townspeople ended up venerating and paying homage to steam and electricity. That's a quotation. And then the author says, contemporary windmills might look like a small town getting a Walmart or like kindergartners getting free iPads. Common sense fails us in two ways. First, and most often, it uncritically believes that technology equals progress. And second, even in cases in which people recognize the potential harm to the community, they generally don't believe that they can resist it. Common sense calls it a waste of time and energy. Quixote rejected this calculus, instead favoring a moral metric to decide who and what to fight. Thus freed, Quixote was left open to fight for lost causes and lose. The the great Sufi sage Rumi hit this right on the head when he said, start some big foolish project like Noah. It makes absolutely no difference what people think of you. And sure enough, in the next paragraph, the author says, warning, quixotic pessimism will not go over well in public. If you choose this life, Unamuno says you will face disbelief, judgment, and ridicule. But just to insert here, the support for doing something about climate change is so broad in the world that I think in this case, many people would not at all feel that way. Because what choice do we have? Just resigning ourselves to drowning in rising seas and seeing climate change and the infestation of insects and other things related to climate change? If you choose this life, Unamuno says, you will face disbelief, judgment, and ridicule. He writes that moral courage, quote, confronts not bodily injury or loss of fortune or the discredit of one's honor, but rather ridicule, one's being taken for a madman or a fool. And this, by the way, is what it used to be like when back in the earlier days of the center, when you would tell people with more conventional outlook that you're practicing meditation. It's changed so much now through this generic mindfulness that you see everywhere. It's acquired a lot more respect, the whole matter of changing one's mind in order to change the world. But at one time, this is what we had to suffer, those of us who, especially those of us who were doing this full-time on staff. The author continues, in a real-life context, quixotic pessimism will look like constantly face-planting in public, and we will need moral courage to accept it. People will laugh at us as they do at Quixote. People will mock our decision to fight big machines, but we must do it neither to win nor to impress. We will eventually grow accustomed to ignoring the criticism of our saner colleagues and friends who seem to follow the adage, if you can't beat them, join them. I'm thinking now also of our stalwart BPF sitters who for years and years and years and years have gone out, met in front of the federal building downtown, and sat in Zazen for an hour every the first Monday of each month in order to make a statement about the need to be peace, the need to be what we want the world to be. Surely many people walking by this little handful of sitters, I've only done it a few times, but there are people who do it in the middle of the winter on a, you know, February 1st in the snow and the ice. Most people would see that as lunacy, but they're doing it. They're doing it because they have to do it. Because it is a demonstration of truth, to use a kind of an empty word, demonstrating the Dharma. She continues, cultivating moral courage amounts to learning to shift our attention away from those who confuse criticism for action toward our own judgment of what is worthwhile, based on thinking a whole lot about what kind of world we would like to live in and the kinds of people we'd like to be. It is worth noting that Quixote went mad from reading books, and this is precisely the type of crazy that Unamuno supports. We may not be able to improve the world, but we can at least refuse to cooperate with a corrupt one. Unamuno himself quixotically resisted Primo de Rivera's dictatorship, publicly criticizing him and his supporters. As a result, Unamuno was removed from his position as university rector in 1924 and exiled to the island of Fuerteventura. After 6 months, Unamuno escaped to France, where he declared he would not return to Spain until Rivera fell or died. Rivera fell and died 6 years later in 1930. Unamuno returned to Spain, but soon became a vocal critic of Francisco Franco, who also removed him from his university post and put him under house arrest. There, Unamuno died at 72 in 1936, at home like Quixote, but unlike Quixote, never having regained his senses. Yeah, so the rest of the story of Man of La Mancha is that Quixote, by the end of the book, regains his so-called senses and gives up his quixotic quests. These intractable problems that we're facing, and have been facing for so long, racism, poverty, hunger, climate change. How can we not continue? If to not continue out of despair is to think that we know what we don't know, is that we just don't know how things will unfold. And to have integrity, it means not being concerned about results. This is true in practice too. Integrity means practicing for its own sake, not in order to get something or have a certain result, but practicing because in practicing we are living in accord with reality, with things as they are, regardless of what good it might do. And then the final paragraph of this article. 3 centuries before Unamuno, Cervantes detailed a life in praise of futilely resisting a corrupt world. Quixote fought giants because he could not, in good conscience, not fight them. We can similarly transform ourselves into quixotic pessimists, the kind who are called dreamers, idealists, or lunatics, rejecting common sense and reinterpreting what constitutes a waste of time. If we happen to succeed by worldly standards, we will be surprised and perhaps pleasantly so. If we fail, we will have expected it. Praise be to uncertain successes and to certain failures alike. There's a saying from the island of Crete that I've pulled out and said in the Zendo, in Sesshin a few times. It goes like this. Leave where you have succeeded. Return where you have failed. You can see this on a granular level of in Zazen itself, in sitting, because we keep failing over and over and over again as we as the mind wanders, and even as we fail to return our attention to the practice after noticing that our mind has wandered. So okay, we can call that a failure. So we go back to the battle, to stay with the practice, to keep returning to the practice. We return where we have failed. There's great dignity, not just dignity, wisdom in doing that. That's how we change. It's how we change ourselves in practice, and it's how the world changes by going back to the battle, even when we've suffered a setback, as we did last week. Another phrase saying that I, like Roshi Kaplan before me, often repeated in Sesshin from a Chinese master: hardship and ease alternate. Therein lies the way. Successes and setbacks alternate. That's the way. That's the Dharma. It's not just an upward trajectory. We just keep doing it because we need to do it. We've seen the way. we see this hardship and ease even here on staff. This the number of people in residence here has alternated for at least several decades, has alternated between expanding and contracting. It's very hard to know why. Sometimes we have the staff grows and then it shrinks and then it grows again and it shrinks and so forth. It's beside the point. We have work to do. We have service to render. We do what we can with the resources we have. And probably, I mean, based on past experience, probably it will expand again. More people will come on staff. But we don't know. But that's beside the point. We just do the best we can. It was very heartening to see the response from all different quarters after this announcement by Trump, the response worldwide to a recommitment to the Paris Climate Accord, and in other ways reaffirmation of that the effort will go on. And in fact, it's been going on. There is an article from The Guardian that Amala Sensei, my Dharma heir in New Zealand, sent. I'll just read a little bit of it here. It says that Trump's rationale that it's a choice of economy over environment and a fossil fuel economy is the top priority, is outdated and false. States and nations around the world have harvested the fruits of clean energy and are redefining their economies and energy sources accordingly. Yet, under false pretenses that, quote, clean coal, natural gas, and other fossil fuel fixes are better than energy conservation and clean energy, the U.S. forges its own lonely path. The idea that clean, renewable energy will generate power for our planet for generations to come is not rhetoric. The extent of human-caused climate change and the rapidly improving economics driving the proliferation of renewable energy sources make it fact. If the U.S. administration isn't ready to move forward, hundreds of individual states and other countries will. And here's the good news. California is already a world leader on climate policy. Texas is rapidly expanding its wind energy capacity. In Germany, clean energy has become a movement itself, focused on thousands of small-scale projects under the Energiewende program. In Scotland, wind generation has increased by 81% over the past year. And in March this year, it produced enough energy to satisfy 136% of the country's household energy needs. These are just a few examples. The U.S.'s withdrawal doesn't mean Americans and U.S. investors will sit still either. There is substantial economic opportunity in renewables. The U.S. solar industry alone creates 1 in 50 new jobs. Worldwide, nearly 10 million people already work in renewable energy. Global clean technology exports doubled between 2008 and 2015. Even America's corporate giants, from Apple and Google to Walmart, and even oil giant ExxonMobil, support the Paris Agreement. So economics are clear. So what about the political implications of the decision? I won't read any more of this. One last, what may appear to be a lost cause, is our own vows. our own four bodhisattva vows. All beings without number I vow to liberate. Boy, isn't that a lost cause? How can we liberate all beings? I've heard this so many times from beginners. What the hell does that mean? I can't even liberate myself. How can I liberate all beings? Endless blind passions I vow to uproot. Dharma gates beyond measure I vow to penetrate. The great way of Buddha I vow to attain. The great bedrock of faith in Zen and Buddhism is that we don't have to attain the great way of Buddha, since we already are Buddha. This is the other side. This is the realm of the undifferentiated, the absolute, the acausal. There's this koan in the Mumonkan where the monk asked a master, Daitsu Chisho Buddha did zazen on the Bodhi seat for 10 kalpas, but could neither manifest the Dharma nor attain Buddhahood. Why was this? The master said, your question is exactly to the point. The monk persisted, why did he not attain Buddhahood by doing zazen on the Bodhi seat? The master replied, because he didn't attain Buddhahood. How can we attain what we already are? Well, how does that relate to climate change? We do have work to do here. But right now, in the state of things as they are now, with this foolish decision last week, even that is the functioning of our true mind. This is the faith aspect of the Dharma. Faith that is, however, confirmed through awakening. That for all the delusiveness of what we've seen, we continue to see, that everything is the functioning of our true nature. Another koan, a monk asked Basso, what is Buddha? He said, this very mind is Buddha. This very world is Buddha. There's nowhere we need to go. There's nothing we need to do. And yet, there is this alarming development in climate change and other causes. There is another koan, number 23 in the Mumonkan. The verse reads, when the universe is destroyed, it remains indestructible. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. Beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma. I bow.